This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to the show. I'm Chua Eun-taek. Giant pandas Fu Hua and Feng Yi arrived at Zoo Negara to much fanfare last May, an act of panda diplomacy capping 40 years of bilateral relations between Malaysia and China. How effective is panda diplomacy and is it still relevant today? Dr. Paul Jepson from the School of Geography and the Environment at the University of Oxford helps us understand. Welcome to the show. Paul, the term panda diplomacy was coined during the Cold War era. What is panda diplomacy?
Yeah, thanks. I mean, panda diplomacy, it's an interesting concept, and it's a term which was used to describe how China was using pandas to further its strategic and national interests. And it started around about the 1950s, and our recent study suggested that we're now moving into a third phase of panda diplomacy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so before we get into the study you did, Chinese civilizations have used pandas as diplomatic gifts as early as the 7th century, according to some studies, and 12 countries currently host pandas from China. Why are pandas synonymous with Chinese diplomacy?
One of the ways I think about this is actually the history of gifting wildlife between nations. So panda is a very famous wildlife gift now. But if we're going back as far as your question suggests, you know, the old Asian sultanates were gifting wildlife between each other. And the idea here is that if you want to give a gift from one entity, one political entity or one country to another, wildlife is a really good gift to give. The reason being that the recipient of the gift can't just put it away behind closed doors. It needs to be kept alive, and it's a point of interest, therefore it is shown. So wildlife has been given since ancient times, because it keeps the giver in the recipient's mind. I mean, to put that in another way, if you had received a gift of wildlife, you know, you have it open in a zoo or in a court or whatever it was, the first thing somebody's going to ask is, where did you get that exotic animal from? And you say the country of origin. So wildlife is a powerful gift between nations or ancient kingdoms or whatever, because it keeps the giver in the recipient's mind and you become talked about. Now that's very much the case for panda nowadays. When a panda is China gifts or loans a panda to another nation, it brings China and the Chinese people, the Chinese nation, into the imaginings of the recipients, and people start talking about China and they start talking about China around this idea of the panda.
Pandas are not the only animals native to China. They have a rich diversity of endemic animals. What values or symbolism do pandas have that other animals do not possess?
I mean, if we think about the panda is a very unique life form, a very special life form. And that's because it's what we call its phenotype, the way it looks, and its behavior, the way it behaves, affords certain emotions or ways of thinking in humans. So what the panda has is two or three things. The first thing is, when you see a panda, you go, it's just lovely. It's sort of cute and cuddly. You know, it affords those emotions of compassion and love, if you like, about it. So it has that thing. And then another aspect of the panda, as we know, it's not very good at breeding. And this resonates with this unlucky in love type idea, which is quite universal, I think, around the world. So the fact that pandas can't get it together, if we like to put it that way, you know, creates that sort of, I don't know, slight humor, empathy with humans. Mm-hmm. And then there's another interesting thing about the panda, is because they're very rare, and because not all zoos have them, or if you like, zoos have to swap pandas for breeding. This is less so now, where many zoos are giving a breeding pair, but previously pandas had to be exchanged between zoos. And this unlucky in love sort of connotation of the panda, which comes from its breeding behavior, promoted lots of nationalistic banter, which again just created, you know, a point of talking. So, you know, a little story that in the UK in the 70s, at the height of the Cold War, we exchanged a panda with Russia, and they weren't able to breed. So, you know, this just created all of this, as you can imagine, nationalistic banter, you know, around things. And that creates a sort of, you know, just a sort of fun and amusement in society. So these are things which the panda has, which really, I mean, no other animal quite has these different dimensions.
In your paper reviewing the history of panda diplomacy, you define three distinct phases. What was China's agenda in during the first phase in the 70s?
Yeah, so I think of the first phase, and the study we did was, you know, looking at patterns of this and coming up with some thinking on this. So the first phase, I think, is quite well accepted, and this is what we might call strategic friend-making. So this was when China was emerging from, you know, a period of isolation in a world which was dominated by the two power blocks, the East and West, or capitalist and communist power bloc. And China didn't want to side with any one of those two power blocks. It wanted to become a third independent power in the world. So probably quite sensibly, it decided to make friends with both sides. And it gave pandas as gifts, you know, during early diplomatic visits. So the visit of Khrushchev, Edward Heath in the UK, Nixon. So this was a gift-giving role of the panda for strategic friend-making.
During the 80s, which was the second phase, it turned from a strategic gift-giving phase into a loaning phase. So receiving countries had to pay China about $1 million every year for each panda they take in. Did it become a money-making venture after that?
I don't quite see it like this. So this was in the Deng Xiaoping era, where China was moving to state-led capitalism and these economic zones where it was attracting in Western industry, manufacturing industries. And there China, you know, realized that not only did it need to attract in Western industries for manufacturing, it needed to create profile in the markets where those products made in China would then be sold back into. So I see, this phase two as a little bit more of a PR and building profile in Western consumer markets or consumer markets for Chinese-produced goods. Now, because this was the state-led capitalist model, then it also seems sensible to move rather from gifting pandas to actually, you know, going into a more capitalistic way of dealing with that relationship. And that's where this idea of the gift loan came in. So not everybody, not every nation could, you know, ask China to rent a panda. It was only certain nations which were in the strategic marketing interests of China which would get the opportunity to loan a panda. But it was because it was in this more capitalistic model which China was moving into.
So we are now in the third phase. When did it begin and how is it different from the previous two?
We started looking at the distribution of pandas in zoos a couple of years ago, and we picked up that something new seemed to be happening, and we were, you know, as geographers, we were trying to make sense of these patterns. So this seemed to have started after the Sichuan earthquake in 2007, so not very long ago, really. And the Sichuan earthquake really damaged panda habitat, but also it really damaged the Chinese breeding center at Wulong. And so China had these pandas in its captive breeding, its panda breeding facility, which needed rehousing, but didn't have a lot of, pandas, as you know, they need quite expensive facilities. It didn't quite have enough facilities to do this. So it seems that China may have thought about, okay, well, let's extend the loans which we've already got out of there, and let's think about a new phase of panda loans. But actually, China's, business interests, I suppose, seem to have changed. And when we looked at the pattern and distribution of new panda loans, we picked up two trends which seem to be quite evident there. One was that pandas were being loaned to zoos in nations which China had a free trade agreements with, of which, you know, your country, Malaysia, is one of these. And the other type, which is where we picked it up with the loan going to Scotland, is the correlation between panda loans going to countries where China is building long-term trade relationships, but for resources which China needs itself. So rather than the second phase was about China marketing goods manufactured in China outwards, this is more securing those long-term trade deals for resources which China requires. And there's, just to give you an example, there's sort of three types of resources we picked up there. One was seafood products, or cold water products. So in Scotland, you know, this was salmon. The other is advanced technologies. Scotland, again, it was relating to know-how in oil, offshore oil technologies. And then the other big one was technologies relating to uranium and nuclear power. And, you know, that matches on to the French and Australian ones. So this is what we see as the third phase, where it's changed to building these long-term strategic trade relationships for goods, products, services, which China requires for its economy, which it needs to, if you like, procure from abroad.
So it's panda diplomacy is like the initiation of going to into agreements like this. So does the negotiation of placing pandas, does it happen at the governmental level or does it happen between zoo professionals?
Okay, two questions there. If I can just take the first one. Mm-hmm. It's not seen so much that the panda is the initiation of it. We felt it was more, if you like, the seal of approval. It's this saying, you know, the trade negotiation is going well. We want to build Guangxi with you. You know, this long-term relationship, trading relationship based on trust, longevity, loyalty. And the panda, by agreeing to a panda loan, it's almost our sort of symbolic seal of that relationship. Because in some ways what China is doing here, the panda is a living national treasure of China. So it's demonstrating trust in a recipient nation, saying, you know, we trust you to look after and care for our living national treasure. And then, of course, the recipient nation or zoo gets a lot in return for that. So we see it as we were seeing it more as a seal of approval, you know, confirmation of the intent for a long-term trading relationship rather than the initiator of that trading relationship. Of course, you know, this is just a proposition. You know, maybe some of your listeners would disagree with that, but that's what we were putting out as a point of discussion. If I just take your second point, so that was about whether this is a deal between governments or between zoos. So this is a little bit complicated. So I just mentioned that pandas are a national treasure of China and a state-led capitalist model. So Chinese zoos and the government institutions responsible for nature conservation, forest and panda, they're all, you know, state institutions. Outside China, some zoos are independent enterprises, which is the case in, you know, the UK, the US. So if you like, they're independent businesses. In other places, and I'm not sure what the case is in Malaysia, they may be state institutions. So the discussion on whether or not a panda will be forthcoming or gifted happens at a governmental level. But, for instance, maybe in Scotland, as we understood it there, the Scottish government sort of facilitated, or in its eyes, facilitated Edinburgh Zoo, which is a private enterprise, to receive a panda. So it's a little bit complicated. It's a sort of a mix of, you know, sort of independent enterprises and governments. But the main point is that the Chinese government decides on who will get a panda.
I've been speaking to Dr. Paul Jepson from the School of Geography and the Environment at the University of Oxford. Coming up, more on the economics of panda diplomacy, BFM 89.9.
This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome back. We're speaking today to Dr. Paul Jepson from the School of Geography and Environment from the University of Oxford about panda diplomacy. Dr. Jepson leads the Conservation Governance Laboratory and is an associate of the Oxford Biodiversity Institute at Oxford University. You mentioned there that pandas are seen as national treasure in China. How does it acquire such a status? Is it because of its scarcity?
First of all, it's worth remembering that in the West, in, you know, the US and Europe, in the 19th century, there was massive interest in natural history, in what was out there in the world, and in exploration. And interestingly, the panda wasn't very well known. It was, you know, there was these other massive discoveries like the great apes, which were public sensations. In the 1930s, an American explorer, she came back to the U.S. with a panda. And although people might have been aware of some sort of rather, you know, not particularly good images or sketches of panda, panda had never been seen. And when panda came back in the 1930s, it was an absolute sensation. I mean, you can imagine that, you know, people were in, they thought they already knew what was out there in the world, in U.S. cities. You know, all of the exciting things had been discovered. And then a panda came into the U.S. And not only did a panda come into the U.S., it came in with a very glamorous 1930s explorer lady who would, you know, drive around New York in her car with the panda in the seat. So it was massive. You know, it was a sensational find. So I think what China realized was that it had an endemic animal which had potential superstar status outside China. And I think it's worked that potential status very well. And there's some things which are specific about the panda which help this. One is, you know, the way it looks and the sort of emotions it affords, which I've taught you about. But I think the other thing is actually its breeding, how shall I put it? The difficulty it has breeding. So it's a really difficult animal to breed in captivity. And because of this, zoo populations or captive populations outside China have never been built up. So if you think of tiger as an example, tiger is quite commonplace outside. You know, I mean, it's even bred in, you know, outside zoos. I mean, it's an easy animal to breed. Panda isn't easy to breed. And that's meant that China has been able to retain ownership and control, if you like, the supply of pandas. So that combination of its superstar status and, if you like, the difficulty of, if, I don't know, zoos, markets to actually breed the panda, I think those are the two things which really create the value of the panda.
I think they call that pandemonium, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Earlier you mentioned that how panda diplomacy is usually seen as a seal of approval, and that, but some countries' zoo are independently run as businesses. So it cost the Toronto Zoo $14 million to host pandas, the Adelaide Zoo $10 million, and it's estimated to cost the National Zoo of Malaysia between $8 to $18 million. And if a panda dies due to human error, the zoo must pay $500,000 US dollars in fines. Given that it's such a high financial investment, is it even a good business proposition for the zoos?
I can give you a couple of perspectives on this, which, you know, may be good for people to debate. Having a panda says something about a zoo. So, you know, zoos are, you know, they're institutions which are based on, if you like, you know, they're based on prestige, just like a great art gallery or even a football team. If you get a panda, or if you're, it moves you into the elite network of zoos. Once you have a panda, you become a prestigious zoo. And then I assume that opens all up all sorts of other marketing and business opportunities beyond the panda for that zoo. So, you know, it might seem a great investment, but I'm sure the zoo managers understand the business of this.
Most of them are among the top trading partners with China. But could you comment on how relations have evolved after the panda has been exchanged or loaned out? Has there been any repercussion or relations that has turned soured, which has caused the Chinese to rethink their panda diplomacy?
We touched on this in our paper. And, you know, again, this was just flagging a couple of things. So there has been a couple of cases where if a nation has upset Chinese, then the Chinese have said, oh, you know, maybe it's time to have our pandas back. I mean, if we think about the Edinburgh situation, actually, or the panda loan there, in part of the reason that that happened was because Norway had annoyed the Chinese by giving a Nobel Prize to an activist. And previously, China got salmon from Norway, and then it switched to Holland as a sort of sign of displeasure on that. And then there was a case where the US president received the Dalai Lama. And again, that sort of angered China. And there was talk about whether the pandas might be recalled from one of the zoos there. So, you know, there does seem to be things there. I don't want to say too much about this because I'm not a political scientist, but there are things to think about there. And maybe the way to think about it is that part of what the pandas symbolize or maybe indicate is that that China wants to do business in the way it does business. You know, there's a Chinese way of doing business. So there might be a Western way of doing business where politics and business are a little bit more disentangled, where business is done on the base of contract and law. But it seems that the Chinese way of doing business, and again, I'm sure your listeners would have views on this, is a bit more about contract plus what we might, you know, what I was using the term guangxi, so trust, loyalty, longevity, and publicly criticizing partners isn't quite the Chinese way. So we are, I mean, pandas, we could say that pandas are quite a good thing to think about in terms of this changing relationship in terms of China, business, and politics.
Conservation has always been put forth to support the giving and receiving of pandas. Do you think the overall effect of panda diplomacy has been to benefit the conservation of pandas?
Well, I'm glad you asked me that. I mean, this is a very good question, actually. So one thing I haven't mentioned is that there is one dimension of panda diplomacy and the exchange of pandas which we need to be aware of. And this relates to a convention called CITES, which is the Convention of International Trade in Endangered Species. Now, what this means is that when a species is endangered and goes on to a particular appendix called Appendix 1, trade is not allowed in this. Exchange is allowed, but only for conservation purposes. So in the Phase 2 panda diplomacy, well, China and the zoos sort of got into trouble because the convention said, no, you're just trading these animals. It's a trade relationship. It's not a conservation relationship. The way that was dealt with was to say, well, actually, these exchanges, they're not about trade. They're about breeding, ex situ, captive breeding of a panda population. And then the gift loans moved from being, you know, 1 year or 2 year to being 10 years, which I think is the case with the current Malaysian one. That conservation legislation did change the nature of the loans. And there is no doubt that in terms of, you know, strategies for conservation, we have what's called in situ, which is conserving in the natural habitat, and then the sort of backup insurance plan, which is ex situ, which is having a captive population. And what we've been talking about, gift loans, however we want to talk about them, have certainly helped build that captive population. And certainly China and the Chinese conservation authorities have benefited from the flows of expertise from, you know, international zoos and conservation experts around the world. Where we're at now is that probably the techniques and technologies of breeding panda, the scientific challenges there have just about been solved. I think particularly the Chinese now, they can breed pandas. The next big challenge, which is part of the overall conservation strategy, is to develop the technologies and techniques for releasing pandas back into the wild, and that is not easy. But of course, until we are able to do that, or until conservation is able to do that, you haven't quite solved the conservation challenge of having a captive population, which, if need be, could be released back into the wild.
Is there still enough places for the panda to be released back into?
I mean, panda habitat is under pressure. It's under pressure from development. There's always the big risk with pandas is that, as you may know, that bamboo flowers periodically, and then it all dies off. So you have these periods of famine for pandas, but then it kicks back in. So in terms of having a captive population, if you've got limited habitat and then you had a bamboo flowering and a famine of food, you could restock from your captive population, which is probably, you know, the main consideration here in panda conservation. What they have found so far is that if you release pandas into habitat which already has pandas. Pandas are incredibly territorial and aggressive, and you know, this is one of the challenges of releasing animals into it. The captive bred animals can fare very badly in that situation.
China, having found the technology to breed and reproduce the panda, is it a sustainable endeavor going forward, panda diplomacy?
Well, I suppose we shall see, but I think if we, you know, if we just sort of reflect on what we've been talking about for the last few minutes, you know, we're identifying three phases of panda diplomacy. This is showing that this asset of China, the panda, this national treasure, it's a special animal which can be used in different ways and in changing circumstances. So the fact that we've got three phases of panda suggests to me that we'll have a fourth and a fifth phase of panda diplomacy. So long as China can limit the supply of pandas outside China, which it seems to be very skilled at doing, and it seems to be very skilled at using panda for, you know, what I feel are generally very positive ends in trade, diplomacy, and international, you know, public relations.
Are there any other nations which use animal native to their land as diplomatic assets?
There used to be quite a few nations which did this. But interestingly, most of the animals we could think about which were previously gifted, now if we think about this, this might be things like gorillas, tigers, some of the rarer animals like Arabian oryx or Przewalski's horse. Most of those are now bred outside the countries, or, you know, the zoos have good populations. So there's no premium in terms of gifting or loaning those animals. I mean, Indonesia used to gift Komodo dragon, which, you know, I think was quite a good one to do, actually. And I'm not sure that they're widely bred. But going back to the CITES convention, you do have to show a captive breeding reason now to do these things. So I think that combination of the law, the convention, and the ease of breeding things outside the country of origin has meant that this practice is rarer than it once was. And maybe it's the panda which, you know, is the one which where we're seeing this still happening. So it's quite unique now.
Dr. Paul Jepson, thank you very much for our time.
Yeah, pleasure. Thanks.
I've been speaking to Dr. Paul Jepson from the School of Geography and the Environment at the University of Oxford about the origins and effects of panda diplomacy. BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.